In this episode of UND's Potluck Podcast, where we host conversations about the arts, English 478 students, Destiny Kidry, Emma Kanak, and Sophia Atkinson, interview writer Alyssa Washuda, a guest of the Kellogg Writers Series, which is a series that brings writers of distinction to the University of Indianapolis campus for classroom discussions and free public readings. Alyssa Washuda is a Native American author from the Cowlitz people of Washington State. She is the author of White Magic, My Body is a Book of Rules, and Starvation Mode. With Teresa Warbutin, she is co-editor of the anthology Shapes of Native Nonfiction, Collected Essays by Contemporary Writers. Washuda is an assistant professor of creative writing at The Ohio State University. We hope you enjoy this episode of UND's Potluck Podcast.
Hello, book lovers. Welcome to the UND Potluck Podcast, which is part of the Kellogg Writers Series. On this amazing October day, we are sitting down to a Zoom call with the talented essayist, Alyssa Washuda, to talk to her about her essay collection, White Magic. Alyssa's honors include a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship, a Creative Capital Award, and the Artist Trust Arts Innovator Award. In her most recent collection of essays, White Magic, Washuda brings the reader on her journey as an Indigenous woman through a series of uniquely crafted essays. She illuminates the consequences that colonization and centuries of oppression have wreaked on Native communities and connects this traumatic history with her identity and her own struggles with addiction, trauma, mental health, and love. It's in her exploration of these difficult issues that we learn of her finding solace in witchcraft and magic and pop culture fixations such as Stevie Nicks, Dare, and the Oregon Trail. Washuda's distinct use of narrative forms allow the reader to follow her consciousness as she questions the struggles she's faced and longs for answers, whether they be from tarot cards or folktales. My name is Emma Kanak, a junior creative writing and professional writing major.
I'm Destiny Kidry, a senior literary studies major.
And I'm Sophia Atkinson, a senior creative writing major, all part of the Kellogg Writers Series class.
Alyssa, thank you so much for making time for us today.
Thanks for having me, Emma. I'm so glad to meet you all.
Well, we're especially glad to meet you. It's truly an honor. So we're just going to dive right into questions and get going. First question we have is that I've already given a little brief overview of your essay collection, White Magic, but how is it that you describe it when people ask you, what is your book about?
Oh, wow. That's a tough one. You know, this is something that's been really hard for me over the entirety of my book writing career. It feels like I'm trying to do something that is sort of irreducible in a way. And, you know, I definitely found with my first book that it was impossible for me to describe. I needed to hire someone to help me craft a description, you know, for querying agents. And it didn't get any easier with White Magic as I thought it would once I was older and had some experience with publishing under my belt. But, you know, so the ways that I have described it in the past include, you know, a book-length lyric essay or a closely linked essay collection or a book-length work of narrative nonfiction. Those are my sort of like formal, touch points as far as like what kind of book is it. And, you know, content-wise, it was always hard to describe while I was working on it, because I was working on it for 8 years and did not know what it was going to be. I had no idea. I think, you know, when I was first writing it, I think I told somebody it was a book about gluten, because that's what I was working on. I was working on stuff about, you know, traditional food systems. And it got really far from that. And eventually, I think I started to describe it as a book about how I got my heart broken and became a powerful witch.
Do you remember when you first became interested in witchcraft and magic? And what is it about these things that excited you?
I think I first became interested when I was a really little girl. And my mom would take me to the library and I would get these books, the Dory series by Patricia Coombs, books about a little witch named Dory, who has a mother who's a big, important witch, and Dory gets into all kinds of trouble. And I just loved those books and I wanted to be in a book. So I wanted to be Dory along with, you know, many other things. I wanted to live in Richard Scarry's town too, and all of that, I'm sure. But I think, you know, when I was a preteen, I think like 12 years old, I saw the movie The Craft, and then I really wanted to be a witch. It was just so cool. I liked the accessories. I liked the look. And, you know, and I think I liked the idea of changing the state of the universe. That just sounded really powerful. And, you know, and I just wanted to believe that there was a way to make things happen that was, you know, unexplainable. So, you know, I had some interest because mood rings and stuff like that, you know, all of that was in popular culture at the time. You know, you could go to Claire's Boutique and buy a mood ring and a choker in, you know, 1996 or whenever it was. And I don't think, you know, I was seriously considering practicing witchcraft until I was in my late 20s. You know, I had been interested when the internet first came into my household, not long after watching The Craft. But, you know, everything I could find on the internet about witchcraft was just indicating that it wasn't for me. I didn't have a coven. I didn't, you know, I didn't have like any of the tools they were talking about. It was clearly very serious and I was 13. So, but, you know, once I was older, I had friends who were witches and friends who read tarot and friends who did astrology. And I realized that those things were actually accessible to me. If I, you know, I could just follow my curiosity and I didn't have to be serious about it. I didn't have to, you know, become a professional astrologer or something. I could just have this private interest. And really that's what it became for me when I was, I think, probably about 30.
That is awesome. Anyways, follow-up question. Do you think of writing as a sort of magic?
Oh, absolutely. I actually, you know, what first comes to mind when I think of writing as magic, I think of it more as like a magic trick. You know, I do think it's magic in the witchcraft sense too, but you know, first I'll talk about it as, you know, magic tricks. I went to a conference for magicians a few years ago and was just really interested in how they talked about their work. And, you know, it was very craft-based and very serious. And I realized, you know, that literary arts and magic arts are not that different in some ways. There's, you know, something that is really illusory about creating a world out of an essay or a story or a poem. There's, you know, it's an attempt to order words in such a way that you evoke something in your audience. And that's not that different from a magic trick, which is, you know, using sleight of hand or, you know, other techniques to, you know, misdirection, et cetera, to kind of manipulate the audience's experience. And in both, they, you know, the audience knows that what they're experiencing is not exact, it's not reality. It's something that is, you know, adjacent to reality or is a bending of reality. So I think of writing as magic in that way. And, but also, you know, I think that eventually it became clear to me that writing was real magic. You know, as I was going through the things I talk about in White Magic, you know, I was doing spells. I was really into astrology. I was really into tarot. And I found that, you know, eventually after I realized I had kind of lost interest in them, I realized that what was happening was that I wanted to control my destiny. I wanted to, you know, control what was going to happen to me and, you know, perfect my future experience so that I would never feel pain and get what I wanted all the time. And that's, you know, obviously not what magic is actually for. But, you know, I think that in the end, I was working towards something with magic that I didn't reach. And as corny as it sounds, like it, you know, the book was the spell that I needed all along. It really was, though. It really earnestly was. It was a magical process of getting this huge, huge story out of me into book form. That was, it profoundly changed my life in ways that I, you know, some ways I understand, just, you know, the act of like making meaning from traumatic experiences is well known to be therapeutic. But there were other things that happened. The ways that my life changed and the things that I had been wanting came into my life after I finished the draft of the book, you know, it really was magical. So I definitely think that, you know, I don't think all writing is magic. I don't think it all needs to be magic, but I do think that writing White Magic was a magical process for me.
That's really awesome. I really like how you talked about it. I never really thought about writing as magic, but like the more you talk about it and the way that you like had like formatted your book, it makes a lot of sense. And you can see like the transformation that you're like talking about throughout the whole entire thing. And I think that's really cool.
Thank you.
Thank you. So we're going to transition away for a little bit from the magic. So music is everywhere in White Magic. You have Stevie Nicks, Phil Collins, Bonnie Tyler, all the Seattle like grunge ghosts. It's clear from your essays that music has a powerful magical properties, like being a mnemonic device or saying the indescribable. Can you tell us a bit more about the role that music plays in this book or like plays for you?
That's interesting. It's so hard for me to talk about in some ways, you know, never fails that when somebody brings up the role of music in my work, I think, oh, I can't write about music. I don't do that, you know? And I think there's something, I do think that it has a subtle presence in the book, or, you know, maybe not for readers, but for me, the power of choosing to write about music, this is a long and roundabout answer, but I'll get there. I feel like for years, starting in high school through college, through my, you know, 20s, it always felt like being able to talk about music, being conversant and like various genres and everything like was, I don't know, something that took something that I didn't have, you know. When I was a college radio DJ, I was like not cool enough to you know, have the great musical taste to get the best time slot or whatever. You know, in high school, I didn't listen to the right Sonic Youth albums and was, you know, a social outcast. And, you know, all of these things happened. And as important as music was to me, it was not something that I really felt I could talk about very much. I very rarely talk to people about any music but Fleetwood Mac. Now that I've written so much about Fleetwood Mac, you know, I think that's something that people start conversations about me, and I feel like I can handle them. But, you know, it's been something that was really intimidating for me for a while to write about music, even though I knew so much about, you know, I knew so much about Nirvana and so much about the Beatles. Like I, you know, was a huge nerd for some of these bands. And so I think that is, you know, I haven't really thought that much about it, but like, I do think that there is something important in that, in, you know, that happened in the writing of White Magic, because it was a book that was so much about, you know, men not recognizing my power. And a lot of that was wrapped up in music, you know, like telling me I didn't have good taste or whatever. I didn't know enough to have a good taste. So I think that, you know, for me, listening to music has always been such a private thing. I don't like listening to music with other people, in part because I like to listen to the same song over and over and over, which is something that I think, you know, that concept really has its hooks in the book, that, you know, that sort of repetitive cycling of you know, whether it's like prayers or spells or, you know, things that we tell ourselves to keep ourselves comfortable, things that we do that, you know, keep us in cycles of self-destruction, cycles that we are forced into without, you know, without our choosing. There's something about repetition that is very powerful to me. And so, you know, I think that all of that is in there. It's very hard to write about other art forms. It's hard to write about music. It's hard to write about video games. Music might be the hardest for me. And I think that, you know, the way that I come at it is through narrative, the narratives of, you know, the bands, of what the music means to me. I can't talk about the craft of you know, creating music. I respect it. I can't talk about it. Don't know, you know, enough of that language or those methods, but I can definitely do the literary version of VH1 Behind the Music. No, that show probably went off the air a long time ago, and you may not have even seen it ever. But it was a big thing that was always in the rotation of things that were always on my little TV screen in my teenage bedroom.
That is awesome. Something that music and your book share is repetition. I know you just touched a little bit on that. We're thinking specifically about the Alice Notley and Lewis Erdrich quotes that appear at the start of each essay in Act Two. It's kind of like the chorus coming back around. What was the inspiration behind this?
I love epigraphs. In my first book, I think every essay may have had an epigraph. And the book certainly had an epigraph. There was, you know, I just love them. It's you know, I know a lot of readers don't like them. People have very strong opinions about epigraphs, which I think is hilarious. Like, who cares, you know? And I think as I was seeing this debate, like, raging on Twitter, which it does periodically, it's like one of, you know, literary Twitter's topics of choice that it rests on every now and then. You know, I saw people discussing epigraphs and why they're useless and why they're distracting and the reader doesn't need them. And I was thinking, you know, I need them. If I'm going to write this book for 8 years, like my weird literary book that I don't even know if anybody's going to publish it, I'm going to put epigraphs in there because they make me happy. And so I and I thought, well, what if I have two epigraphs for every essay in this book that I'm working on? And then I thought, what if they're the same epigraphs over and over, just to be really irritating? I just, you know, in the writing process thought it was funny. It was just like amusing to me to do this. And I thought, there's no way that an editor is going to let me keep these. My editor had no problem with them. He liked them too. And, you know, and so I kept them. And, you know, since publication, I've realized that it's sort of one of those things that I guess like really demonstrate for me the fact that the meaning in the book is not created by me alone. It is a collaborative process between me and readers and readers and each other. If they're talking to each other, like you all are in, you know, your educational context, like, there's meaning that readers find there that I didn't consciously intend, but I love it. You know, I think one of the earliest readers of the manuscript draft was a colleague who talked about the epigraphs as a kind of like spell or incantation that's said over and over. And I love that. Like, I didn't intend that, but yes, it's there if she sees it, you know? And I think that, you know, they're, those two particular poems were ones that I chose because I just cherished them. So the whole Alice Notley poem is in there. It's an untitled poem. And I had permission from Coffee House Press to include the whole poem. I just wasn't able to get in touch with Louise Erdrich for permission for the poem I wanted to use of hers. And just because of my own, I just dropped the ball on it. So I cut it down to just a couple of lines that were meaningful to me. And yeah, and I think that it's, in a way, I think of my books as scrapbooks of the things that I love the most. And so I wanted those poems to be in my scrapbook.
I think that's really interesting because while we're reading this book, we were doing these reader responses on it. And one of my things that I noticed, I was like, there's a lot of just extra stuff in this novel and in this collection of essays. It's like, it's not necessarily like part of the text itself, but it adds on. And I always thought those were really interesting because I feel like often writers may take like their writing a little too seriously. And so I like to see that little like breakup where you're talking in these epigraphs and you're addressing the audience. And I'm like, it's kind of creepy. but I loved it anyways. And I mean, like that and then like emojis, it's all stuff that we have future questions on. But these next few questions kind of get into some of the tough things in the book. So feel free to like sidestep if you want to, or like kind of answer them in a roundabout way if that's what's more comfortable. But you write frankly about traumas you've experienced and the long and vast history of trauma that continues to be inflicted upon Indigenous peoples, especially sexual abuse of women. Can you give us a sense of what it was like for you to re-enter those hurts over months and years of writing and revising, and what it's been like to hear and read responses to those particular parts since the book's publication in 2021?
Yeah, you know, I think of this as sort of a process question that feels like so practical to me now that I'm like teaching creative writing. You know, it was a very different experience writing White Magic from writing My Body is a Book of Rules. In my first book, you know, I was writing it, I was not sober. I was like actively intoxicated the whole time probably that I was writing, and, you know, was not in a great place mentally at all. The things were happening that I was writing about, you know, I was writing about them as they were happening. It was terrible. And, you know, of course, White Magic is about sobriety and among many other things. And so, you know, I wrote the whole book sober. And yeah, and, you know, I think that like having just always having the clarity of sobriety allowed me insight into what I was experiencing in the writing process. And I realized that, you know, even though I was going to therapy weekly and was really in a very healthy place mentally and was no longer having PTSD panic attacks or anything, you know, I was really solid by the time I got to my first major revision of the book in, I think it was like November 2019 or something like that. And yet I found myself being pulled into these, you know, sort of like obvious PTSD episodes, not severe ones, not severe panic attacks, but I noticed that, that I was experiencing some of the old thoughts coming back of being fearful, basically of worrying that I was not perceiving things in a way that was, you know, close to the truth. And I only realized afterward what was really happening. And so, you know, I think that was really instructive for me in my process moving forward with so many different parts of the work, even thinking about like how much I'm able to talk about what happened to me. I just don't always have the energy to sort of like get into it. I have endless energy, it seems, for like talking about craft and everything. But, you know, I have to pay attention to what I have capacity for. And so, yeah, you know, I think that as far as reader responses, that is a really interesting part of it that I think also has evolved for me over time. I was just talking to my students about this. When your agent is taking a book out on submission, you know, my agent and does this, and I think most probably do, they check in with you about what you want to hear as far as your rejections go. And I said, I want to hear everything. my agent said, "Are you sure?" I said, "Oh yeah, I'm a creative writing professor. I do this, you know, critique stuff all the time." I realized that I still felt really tender about the book, and that's okay. And I think that really informed my teaching too, to realize, like, you know, there are different phases of the process. And depending on what the work is about, who we are, where we are in our healing, or, you know, even regardless of that, some things might be too tender for some kinds of feedback. And like, that's fine. I still, you know, I spent a long time with the book by myself, alone, perfecting it as much as I could. And so, you know, at this point, I choose not to look. I completely deleted my Goodreads account, and I don't look at like Amazon reviews or anything. I'll, you know, typically if a review of the book comes out, I'll skim it sometimes, or just kind of skip it other times, because ultimately those reviews are not for me. I think like talking to readers and hearing that the book is meaningful to them, like that's meaningful to me. But you know, I don't need to hear anything negative about the book, because I did do everything I could to really put, you know, make it like an interior map of my heart in a way. Yeah, I think that's my sort of roundabout answer to that. Just, it is, I guess, you know, there's one more piece of this answer though, which is that I realized, you know, after the book had come out and interviews were over, and, you know, it was just like summer of 2021 and things were quieting down, I realized, you know, I'm not sure that I would still be talking about this trauma, or I would not still be thinking about this trauma in the way I do if I weren't writing about it and publishing about it. And I think I might be ready to let it go. And I started thinking about that then and deciding that then. And I've, you know, I think that has, that feeling has grown a lot stronger since then. It has made it so that I can sort of think more about the writing process and writing about trauma now that I have decided that I'm done writing about it, at least for now, that I'm moving on to other topics. And I've investigated that as much as I can. It's an interesting new experience for me to have new subject matter.
Yeah, that's really awesome. Because I remember we talked in class a little bit about like how personal this book is, and how I was thinking about how much it could help other people that have been in situations that you've been in. And I just think it's so amazing, like, that you were so open to talk about it, like, even if it was so painful and it brought up a lot of memories. It was just awesome to hear, like, read about this and learn about an author in things that most people wouldn't talk about. So I think it's really awesome that you did this.
Thank you. You know, I feel like there's so, this is something I've really learned as a professor, and before that as an academic counselor. So many people in, you know, environments like ours are suffering in ways that certainly when I was in college, like, we didn't talk about. There just wasn't really anybody that I knew that I could talk to about what was happening to me. And I just think that it helps to be able to, you know, to hear what's worked for somebody and just hear that there's ways to get through it. I'm sort of an open book. And so I'm happy to be the person who can kind of tell that stuff, you know. I've always felt like that with my writing. Like, I can just, you know, I don't have a lot of a filter in my first drafts at all. And later I'll filter for the sake of the reader. But, you know, I'm happy to take on that. I don't think of it as a burden, but what would be a burden for other people to share what happened to them? It's not a burden for me. So I'm happy to do it because I think it's important for people to talk if they can.
Yeah, that's really it's really awesome. And to like kind of get out of that like mood, because I know like we had this really like kind of personal question. I think it's like the time to shift into some craft questions to make you feel like a little more comfortable and talk about like what you said you like talking about.
I'm comfortable. I love your questions, by the way. This is great. And I do think that is a craft question. I think it really is a serious craft issue, and we need to acknowledge it as such because it is part of the process. Like, that's why I said I think that this is a process question. Like, we're not machines, and we need to, like, you know, I think it's really beneficial for us to acknowledge that the writing process can affect us. Like, it can make us happy. It can make us hurt, you know, it can. And I think that, like, you know, my life has been better since I acknowledged that, and my writing has been better too. So I thought it was a great question, but I'm happy to move on too, to whatever you want to ask.
So our next question is about the structure that you have, the three-act structure, and how you arranged it into three different parts with all your essays. Was that a choice that you guided from the beginning, or was it something that just came along the way as you're writing?
Yeah, I'm going to take a look at the table of contents because, like, I know that it was a multi-part process. So the ordering of the essays was a separate separate wave of revision from the, like, imposition of the three-act, like, explicit three-act structure. So I kind of, once I had all of the essays drafted, or maybe not all of them, I had a good chunk of them drafted, I realized that I had a feeling in my gut that where it needed to start was the sort of, like, narrative present in that period that I was writing in and about. In the first essay, Little Lies, takes place in fall 2017. You know, that was sort of like where the stakes were alive for me. You know, that I could not get my ex-boyfriend to text me back. And that was really what was on my mind then. And it just sort of, I just had this, like, intuitive sense that that was the way into getting to the past. And so that, you know, that first act begins with that sort of, like, late 2017 period, and then kind of gets pulled back to the past for the next few essays. You know, starting with childhood and going to, like, Seattle years and et cetera, et cetera. Because I realized, okay, to explain why I am hung up on my ex-boyfriend, it is actually an interesting narrative question to me. And the exploration requires that I go into the past to examine where I came from, who I became, you know, what I was doing the previous few years. And then, you know, gets back to that relationship in Act Three and sort of resolves it. So that's how I did how I organized the collection. And then my agent had given me some feedback on the first draft. And I realized that, you know, all of that I just said was clear to me. And it was, you know, the whole shape and movement of the book was clear to me. But that was just, you know, in my mind, that was not really, you know, a reader might be able to find that, but there was, like, no real evidence of it. There's no guiding structure. So that's when I put the three-act structure in, to sort of show the reader that this is not just a collection of linked essays, not to diminish the value of linked essay collections. I love them. But part of what I was relying on in this book was that it was not, that these essays were seen as interdependent. I needed the reader to recognize that this was, you know, not something they could read in any order, that it was, you know, it was beginning to end narrative. So, and, you know, at the beginning of each act, there's a little, like, a page or two about narrative structure. I did that in part to underscore what I just said, like, just to get the reader thinking about the structure of stories, how we construct them in our lives, and to think of this as, like, a book-length essay with many parts, maybe. So that was kind of what I was thinking of in doing that.
That's really interesting, especially whenever you were talking about the ex-boyfriend trauma. I've also dealt with a similar thing with ex-boyfriends, but also, like, being hung up with the trauma from that past. A similar question, you use many interesting narrative forms. I know you also touched a little bit on that. I don't think you repeat the same one twice in the book. Was it something about the subject matter that led you to decide on the form? Or did you start with the form to harness the subject matter?
Ooh, good question. I think, you know, let me think about that. So I think, you know, part of that is I think due to the fact that I was writing this over a number of years and had different sort of like fascinations in form over the years. And I do think that for me, when I'm working on a book, it can just seem like I'm writing about everything. The subject matter is everything in the world. That's true of my current project. It's like everything in existence. That's what my book is about. And that's really what White Magic was about for me at the time, you know, everything that I had ever been concerned with. That's the way my mind moves through the material. I think that that's really what it comes down to with the essays in this collection. I need some kind of structure to, like, that I can impose on the drafting process so that it's just not like chaos. I mean, it's still chaos, but there's some way to navigate that chaos. And I know that, you know, in writing these essays, I think that there was no single form that I identified that could sustain everything that I wanted to do and everything I wanted to explore. So I knew that, you know, my overall narrative approach is usually to use fragmentation and to kind of do a sort of weaving of different subjects, et cetera. But, you know, I think that I kind of just, whenever I'm writing anything, I just start out and I can't really start out until I have a sense of like what the form is sort of going to be. And then I just keep doing it until it's done. And each of these explorations was done before it was anywhere near the length of a book. And it was clear that it was just a part of a book. So I think that's where I was at with that. Different books are going to take different approaches for me. But I think that that was the one that has served me in my last two books, is like that sort of lens that shifts when the whole image is seen.
There is something like interesting about some of the narration that we noticed with like what you're writing. One that we specifically pointed out in class while we were talking is what you did in the Spirit Cabinet. You have a bunch of memory fragments that are dated and like interwoven with quotes from the television series Twin Peaks and the writings of Mark Twain and various of magicians. It reads like we are in a memory palace or a haunted house, and the tension that builds across the gathering is really wielding like a strong magic. How did you come to the realization that this particular narrative form was the one for the book's type of climax?
That was so much fun to write. You know, I think that I had a feeling. So basically, I had drafted everything before that point in the book and had sort of arranged it. And I don't remember exactly how I, you know, came to realize everything about how I was going to do this. But I know that a lot of that section concerns a couple of trips to Seattle to see people, mostly my ex-boyfriend. And, you know, as things were happening, he and I realized, like, mostly I realized, and he acknowledged that maybe I was right. I realized, like, oh my gosh, we were doing the same thing on this day a year ago. And that was happening a lot. And it was really eerie. When I got back to Ohio after that, I was just hanging on to those experiences so much. And I felt like something supernatural had happened. You know, a couple of the most striking things were that I was at a restaurant. I think there's a restaurant that I write about that I was, you know, realized I was at that restaurant on the same day 2 years in a row or something like that. And it happened a few times with various things. And so I thought, all right, there's something supernatural happening. That is like what I believe, and that is sort of the premise of the book. And if I'm going to investigate this, I need to just truly, fully experiment and see what's going to happen. And so I just took these index cards And I just wrote the events that seemed spooky, you know, like the things that Carl and I had done together. I just wrote them on cards and, like, you know, other things that were happening over that period. And I started, you know, looking at my calendar to see what I'd done, and looking at my email and, you know, texts and all of that to kind of piece together these timelines. And as I was working on those sections, I would find other things that were in my notes from magicians and Twitter and, you know, stuff like that, and just realized I could fold those in. And it was, I mean, it was my favorite writing project I've ever done to create that essay, The Spirit Cabinet, because it was truly magical to just see these timelines unfolding. And so I wanted to keep those fragments, like, pretty clipped, pretty short, pretty unadorned, to kind of, like, just let the timeline mixing stand out. It's a polarizing essay. A lot of people who have read it, I think, do not like it at all, and that's okay. But, you know, I do think that, like, I'm proud of that as a successful experiment and, like, a successful example of just letting go in my writing and just trusting the drafting process and not having a predetermined outcome, which is what I always say my writing process is, but it really was in that instance.
I think that's very interesting about the note card thing. I've actually recently learned that technique in one of my classes with actually Professor Haney. Also, in the Spirit Cabinet essay, we are introduced to all these wonderful non-existent emojis. The first one being a chipmunk holding the beating heart of its enemy. Two, a dove holding not an olive branch, but a page on which all one's secrets are written. And the last one, a beheaded dragon's body that tells us whether efficacy is in the heart or the brain. The list of emojis is a really beautiful poem and one of the things I really liked in your book. Have you ever tried creating these emojis, or has anyone taken you up on making them?
Oh my goodness. I love that idea. I love it. No, I have not. I'm not, I kind of, like, gave up on any dreams of, like, being able to do visual art a long time ago. So I haven't tried to do it myself, but I would love to have those emojis made for me. There's actually an emoji that was made for me that's in this book that I really love this. In my heartbreak workbook, there's, you know, emojis as, like, sort of like ornaments between sections. And in my manuscript that I submitted to my publisher, I had included the Apple versions of those emojis. You can't publish those in a book. They're, like, copyright protected or whatever. So we were trying to figure out what to do. And I realized the Twitter emojis are, you know, they can be used by anyone. They just need attribution. And, you know, that's, Twitter's fine too, because the book is so much about Twitter. And so we did that, but the shark emoji on Twitter, I did not care for their version of the shark emoji. And so Jacob Valla, the designer of the book, created the shark emoji for me. So that, you know, is on page 274. That's a Jacob original made for White Magic. It is one of my most cherished things.
That's really cool. I mean, the emojis were, like, one thing that we talked about so much. And, like, I know when you said that, like, there was one created specifically for you, like, all of our mouths just kind of, like, dropped. We're like, no way. Like, it is all connecting. But sadly, that's all the time we have for, like, regular questions. So now you gotta prepare yourself for, like, the super tough questions. These are all, like, right. These are, like, really hard, just an FYI. It's a segment of the podcast that we like to call the lightning round.
Oh my goodness. Right. See if so my mind can move quickly enough.
Don't worry about, like, you don't have to go, like, super fast or anything. These are just, like, super fun questions that we're just, like, throwing in, you know. We just want to get to know you, right? Kind of, like, chill down from, like, the super intense questions that we've been asking. The first one we have is, what is your favorite restaurant in Columbus, Ohio?
North Star. There's a few locations. It's a place where there's only one dish I get, the Buddha bowl. And I used to go there all the time after work. I just am so exhausted by my life that I cannot possibly cook ever. And so I had to stop the North Star habit, but it is a place that I used to love to go to when I was still dining indoors.
All right. So next question. You've been selected to be in a duet karaoke world championship.
Yes.
You can pick one fellow writer to join you. Who will it be and why? It can be dead or alive. Any
Tommy
writer.
Tommy Pico. No question. Tommy, I've done karaoke with Tommy several times, and I just feel like the energy would be amazing. I love hearing Tommy sing karaoke, and I miss him. We haven't done karaoke in a while, so that would be my choice.
All right. If you were to create a video game, what would it look like?
I don't know. I feel like this would be if I like had it commissioned, if I were the sort of like creative director of all of it, because what I want is like very complex. I would want like something like Red Dead Redemption 2, where the graphics of the natural world are so good that like it feels like I'm in a movie. That's what I want. I want to feel like I'm in a movie. And I want it to take me through all of the places that I miss, because I haven't been traveling for a while now. I would want to go back through Seattle. You know, I would want to go through all of these places that I love that I haven't been to for a while, and to just like find artifacts, have a little bit of combat, you know, just like some of the dopamine stuff in video games. Somebody would have to create a beautiful plot for me. That I can't do. Someone else has to handle it. But I think that would be, you know, that those are some of the pleasures of the video game for me, are like settings, graphics, finding stuff, like reading the little things that come up when you find an artifact and trying to piece it together. Yeah. And you have to have lots of outfits. That's one of the best things about any video game, with outfits, like really good outfits, like Cyberpunk 2077. Those are some of the things on my wish list.
That is so cool. All right. Our last and final question for the lightning round is, describe your very best dance move.
Oh, I don't, sitting down, just sitting down and not participating. I do not dance.
You have to.
Oh no, no. I maybe just like shuffling out of the room to go stand on the patio outside of the wedding or wherever I'm supposed to be dancing and just pretending that there's an emergency on the phone. That's probably it.
No, I that would probably be my answer. It's creative writers, I guess we don't have the dance moves, but that was it for the lightning round, sadly. And that is unfortunately the end of the Potluck podcast. We had such a great time. Alyssa, thank you so much for making time for us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for all your good questions. It was so good to talk to you.
Yeah, we had so much fun with this. And if you are wanting to learn more about Alyssa and her books, you can go to her website at washuta.net. And while you're on the internet, just like click on over to your favorite independent bookstore and purchase a copy of White Magic, if you haven't already. I mean, everyone already has, right? And on behalf of the Kellogg Writers Series and the University of Indianapolis, I'd like to thank our listeners for tuning in. We hope you'll join us again for our next episode, when we'll be visited by novelist and short story wizard Matt Bell. Be kind, Ooh. Everyone.
Thank you for listening to the UND Potluck Podcast, hosted by students and faculty of the University of Indianapolis. We would like to thank our guests as well as the Shaheen College of Arts and Sciences. To learn more about the UND Potluck Podcast and hear other episodes, please visit etchings.und.edu. Thank you for your support of UND students and the arts.